In today's episode of the Daily Brief, I'll talk about two interesting stories. I first talk about how shipbuilding works, and in the second one, I talk about SEBI's order against Man Industries. Welcome to the Daily Brief show by Zerodha, where our aim is to simplify the biggest news in the financial markets in a way that's much more deeper and contextual compared to the news channels. I'm your host Krishna. Today is Wednesday, 1st of October. Now, coming to the first story. See, we often talk about global trade, China's manufacturing dominance, and India's aspiration to become a big player in the global supply chain. These themes usually appear in isolation, but today they intersect in a fascinating way through the shipbuilding industries. See, 90% of the world's goods move by sea. Naturally, this level of global trade needs ships, which, while not often most talked about, are arguably the most important plumbers of global commerce. As with many other industries, China holds the crown here too. It has captured an extraordinary 53% share of global shipbuilding, rising from third place to first in just over a decade. India, meanwhile, is starting to smell the opportunity. The government recently approved a 69,725 crore package to revitalize India's shipbuilding and maritime sector. Now, that's a large push in a sector that doesn't often make headlines. That's what led us to nerd down the rabbit hole of shipbuilding and create a primer on how the industry works. With no pun intended, let's dive into it. See, the key fact that you should know about shipbuilding is that it's not just about constructing shiny new vessels. Fundamentally, it's three businesses rolled into one. The first is building, which involves taking an order, designing and assembling a ship from scratch. The second is repair and maintenance, keeping ships seaworthy through their 20 to 30 year lives, including mandatory surveys, overhauls and retrofits. And the third is recycling, what the industry politely calls breaking, where old ships are dismantled and their steel is sold back into the market. Think of it as a life cycle: build, operate, repair, recycle. As one would expect, the demand for ships largely matches with global trade cycles. Without ships, iron ore doesn't reach steel mills, oil doesn't reach refiners, and those electronics you ordered don't reach your doorstep. Energy flows also matter hugely. When LNG exports booms, order for ships that carry LNG surge. Ships have other large use cases too, like tourism or even as warships for national defense. Clearly, many different economic engines feed into this one industry. Ship demand comes in two forms. Either new ships are made to accommodate more trade demand, or older vessels with 20 to 30 year lifespan are replaced with new ones. A striking feature of the industry is that it's incredibly concentrated, with three countries making up over 90% of the world's ships. China makes up roughly 53% of the market, South Korea follows with 28%, and Japan holds around 12%. Everyone else combined, including the US, Europe, and India, hardly have any share. And it wasn't always this way. 20 years ago, Japan was on top. But with aggressive state policy, patient capital, and a relentless push for scale, China leapfrogged to number one. You see, ships come in many flavors, each tailored to a very specific use case. It could be bulk carriers carrying low-value, high-volume cargo like grains, coal, and iron ore. Then there are crude oil or chemical tankers that transport crude oil and refined products. Container ships, the most visible to us, move everything from furniture to electronics in those huge multicolored containers. Then there are LNG and LPG carriers, highly specialized with insulated tanks to carry gas at sub-zero temperatures. Roll-on, roll-off ships are specialized cargo vessels designed to transport wheeled cargo like cars, trucks, and trailers. The question you might have next is, how do shipbuilders even build ships? Well, here's the thing. Ship factories or shipyards don't work like car factories. In fact, it may be more useful to think of them as construction or EPC contractors for heavy industries. Let's break this down. Shipbuilders don't stock up ships as inventory waiting for someone to buy. What they sell is a contract to build for the specific need of a customer at a specific delivery slot. A ship obviously takes a long time to build, and for that reason, the customer is allowed to pay in milestones instead of all at once. In advance when the deal is signed, then tranches at steps and the balance at the delivery. Now that the contract is signed, let's look into shipyard. It works like a project manager of sorts, taking care of a complex supply chain, wielding steel and integrating thousands of systems into a single huge asset that can comfortably float at sea. As a result, the build process is complex and fascinating. Shipbuilding starts with design, ship concept drawing that must be approved. Once that's done, the first piece of steel is cut. Next comes block fabrication, where massive sections of the ship body are built separately. These blocks are pre-fitted with as much piping, wiring, and cabling as possible, just like in construction projects. The more you can pre-fit, the faster and cheaper the full assembly ends up being. The blocks are then welded together to form the full hull or ship body. In Korean and Japanese yards, more than 80% of the outfitting is completed before the final assembly. In India, that share is much lower, which is why ships here take longer to build and end up costing more. After that comes the launch or float out when the hull touches water for the first time, the first of many tests for any ship. At the berth, workers install engines, cabins, electronics and safety gear, which are procured from various vendors and put together so that the ship starts taking its final shape. Then come proper trials, when full-scale performance and safety tests are done. If the ship passes, it's delivered to the owner. This can take anywhere between 2 to 10 years based on the size and the complexity of the ship. Now that we know the basics of how ships are built, let's look at how East Asian countries aced each step of the process, overtaking Western countries. Firstly, you need access to relatively lower-cost skilled labor. Welding, cabling, piping and outfitting are all labor-intensive processes. Even in the most high-tech yards, thousands of workers are needed on the shop floor. Countries like China, South Korea and Japan had an edge in this labor cost arbitrage. Second, you need dense supplier clusters. A modern ship has thousands of parts. Engines, thrusters, navigation systems, pumps, valves, coatings and so on. No single yard makes all of this in-house, and ideally, you need the suppliers of these parts to be close to a shipyard. The best shipbuilding nations have built ecosystem where dozens of specialized vendors sit around the yard, feeding parts just in time. Without that ecosystem, every order adds more cost and time. However, the most important ingredient of all is cheap long-term capital. Just think about it. A ship order is a multi-year project. Shipbuilding obviously requires high capex, but it also needs lots of working capital to pay suppliers and manage long lead times. And this amounts to 35 to 40% cost of the shipbuilding. If the capital is expensive, the math doesn't work. This is precisely where China pulled ahead of everyone else. Its state banks are well known to provide patient and low-cost funding to priority sectors, and shipbuilding is one of them. But they also provided refund guarantees, giving buyers confidence that their advances were safe. Otherwise, many international buyers won't even consider a yard. Now, where does India stand in all of this? Unfortunately, India hardly builds 2% of the world's ships. That's tiny for a country that depends on shipping for 95% of its trade, which really represents a massive opportunity. However, we end up using foreign-made ships to transport most of our trade and haven't yet capitalized on it. But why? Well, it's for the opposite of the exact reasons China, Japan, and South Korea are dominating. Firstly, working capital is expensive in India. In India, interest rates are often around 10%, far higher than the global competitors. That makes every ship order less competitive. Add to that difficulty of getting refund guarantees and insurance, and it's easy to see why most orders slip away. Now, that is in the end of our financing issues though. Now, because of our regulations, Indian ships aren't classified as mortgageable assets under the Surfacey Act, nor do they legally count as infrastructure. That means banks can't lend against them, and long-term loans at competitive rates are rare. Even public institutions dedicated to infrastructure financing like NIIF or IIFSCL can't fund shipbuilding because of a legal barrier. That shuts off the cheap institutional capital that shipbuilding needs. Secondly, we depend on imports of the ship parts themselves, such as propellers, engines, high-capacity diesel generators, and control systems. Now, these aren't produced domestically at scale, which not just means higher costs through imports, but also lack of supplier clusters that are necessary to optimize shipyards. Hence, Indian shipbuilders face delays and cost overruns. Then there's the technology itself. Many Indian shipyards still use outdated production methods with low levels of automation. As we mentioned before, in comparison to China and Japan, India does far less pre-fitting of parts, which drags out timelines and raises costs. Productivity per worker is also much lower. Now, the government understands this, which is why this September it stepped in with a monster 69,725 crore package. It's designed as a four-pillar push to give Indian shipyards the support they've never really had. A large part of this package is dedicated to making the most important ingredient, which is cheaper capital. The Shipbuilding Financial Assistance Scheme, for instance, has been extended all the way to 2036, along with a 24,000 crore kitty. Additionally, the package contains a new maritime development fund worth 25,000 crores for long-term financing. Of this maritime development fund, 20,000 crore is dedicated to investment where the government personally buys a stake for nearly half the capital needs. The remaining 5,000 crore is meant to reduce interest rates for shipyard loans. Now, all of this should subsidize Indian yards so that they can quote more competitive prices when bidding against foreign rivals. Meanwhile, the government is also doubling down on more shipyard capacity. The Shipbuilding Development Scheme, worth 20,000 crores, is aimed at scaling India's shipbuilding capacity to 4.5 million gross tonnage. That means new mega yard clusters, better infra, dedicated technology centers, and even risk insurance for shipbuilding projects. In other words, building an ecosystem and a strong supplier clusters, not just a yard here and there. Now, to tie all the ingredients together, the government is setting up a national shipbuilding mission, making it a priority sector. Now, this is supposed to oversee all the money flows, keep the regulations aligned, and make sure the big vision doesn't get lost in bureaucracy. This story is mostly an attempt to map out the basics of how the shipbuilding works and where India stands. There is a lot more to dig into that we hope we do in a sequel to this. The green transition, for instance, is already reshaping demand, with new ships being ordered to run on LNG or methanol instead of oil. Then there's the story of actual companies in India like Cochin Shipyard and others that are slowly making moves in this space. And of course, the bigger, harder question: will India's latest 69,725 crore push actually change the game, or will it end up as another ambitious industrial policy that falls short in execution? But if these reforms actually deliver, Indian shipyards could actually finally scale up, attract global partners, and maybe move from being a fringe player to a serious contender. By the way, if you want to discuss more on stories we cover and other interesting things, join our community on Reddit at r/marketsbyzerodha. You can check out the link in the description as well. One of the complications of trying to understand a listed company's business is that so often much of its actual business is happening through a list of different companies that it has interest in, subsidiaries, JVs, associates, and more. To really judge a company's performance, then, its standalone financial statements aren't enough. You need to figure out what's happening across all of these layers. That's why SEBI asked listed companies to come out with what are called consolidated financial statements. Companies have to report the combined financial performance of all these companies, cutting through the technicalities of their corporate structure as though they were all a single business. Now, what happens if you don't do so? Well, that gives you room to hide away all sorts of secrets. Now, that's the thing you should take away from SEBI's recent order against Man Industries. See, Man Industries makes and exports massive carbon steel pipes. Those pipes are used in several important industries, from oil and gas to fertilizers to water suppliers. The company counts some giants among its clients, from global majors like Shell and Sinopec to massive Indian companies from Indian Oil to L&T. And they've brought the company healthy earnings. Last financial year, for instance, the company saw revenues of over 3,500 crores, which translated into a net profit of 105 crores. Behind all this success, however, was a small problem. For many years, the company quietly kept a subsidiary off its books. In 2013, Man Industries merged with another company, Man Infra Projects. The Bombay High Court gave the merger its blessing in 2015, and under the law, the two companies had become one since April 2013. As part of the merger, the company had gained a wholly owned subsidiary, Merino Shelters. But for many years afterwards, it didn't seem to acknowledge the company in its books, even as it kept routing money through it. In fact, for 1 year, which is FY 2014-15, the company dutifully consolidated Merino Shelters' results with their own. But then they stopped, and they didn't do so for another 6 years. Year after year, for every financial year until FY 2021, the company's financials pretended as though Merino Shelters just didn't exist. Now, for the record, the company's promoters claimed that there were legitimate reasons not to fold Merino Shelters into its financials. There was supposedly a major fight over the company's control within the promoter's own family, including a pending case before the Bombay High Court. If they had gone ahead and consolidated those results into their financials, they could even be hauled up for contempt. SEBI, however, didn't think this was much of a reason. After all, the Bombay High Court hadn't really said anything stopping them from doing so. There was no real reason for them to fear the court's wrath. Now, if they weren't really trying to heed the Bombay High Court's orders though, why else would they hide a whole subsidiary? Why shy away from reporting the performance of a whole company? Well, because if you're so inclined, a hidden subsidiary can help you hide away a lot else. Anything you don't want your investors to see. One benefit of having this subsidiary hidden, though a relatively small one, was that Man Industries' profits looked bigger than they were. Now, over those 6 years, Merino Shelters consistently made losses. Rightfully, all those losses were losses of Man Industries as a whole and should have been shown as such. If consolidated, they would have depressed its results. Now, to be fair, these losses weren't too large. Through those 6 years, it made a cumulative 4.73 crores in losses. Compared to the relatively huge revenues of Man Industries, these would have been a drop in the bucket. This non-consolidation barely moved the company's profits up by 1 to 4%. But eventually, to SEBI, that didn't matter. They did distort the picture that Man Industries investors saw, even if that distortion was small. Once a company starts flouting disclosure norms, it doesn't matter how much that benefited the company. There are some accounting malpractices that you are simply not permitted to commit. Period. There was a bigger benefit of keeping Merino Shelters off the books. Because the company was about to use it to funnel money to a range of entities performing many little bits of financial jugglery, if it were consolidated, many disclosure requirements would have kicked in, making those transfers easier to spot. But by keeping it off the books, Man Industries found it easier to dress things up. Merino Shelter became a key conduit through which Man Industries pushed out hundreds of crores from the company. On paper, these looked like standard loans and advances. From there, that money would be routed to other related companies such as Man Reality, another part of the larger group. This was part of a larger trend where huge sums of money was being routed to entities connected to the company's promoter family. In FY2019, for instance, over 48 crores were loaned to Limitless Contracting, which was owned by the daughter of the company's promoter. In FY2018, 40 crore was advanced to 6 related companies only to be written off. Now, what were these loans for? We don't know. The company didn't mention that, nor did they follow the procedures they had to in order to give those loans. Sometimes that money just disappeared. Sometimes it was paid back. Sometimes it was repaid on paper only to be loaned once again. In an ideal case, if Merino Shelter's results were consolidated with those of Man Industries, a lot of this would leave a paper trail. But because it was hidden away, there was only a single number investors could look at to understand what was happening, the amount that the company was due to receive. In its books, these loans would look like cash that had gone out and receivables that were yet to come in. And that single number could be dressed up. See, a company's financials don't give investors a year-round sense of how its balance sheet moves. They simply get a single snapshot. What was happening in the company on March 31? As long as the company looks healthy on that one particular day, its activity over the rest of the year remains invisible. Now, this is what Man Industries consistently took advantage of. Every March 31, a lot of the money that the company had loaned would suddenly reappear in its accounts. Its related entities would take large overdrafts, usually using Man Industries' own fixed deposits with the bank as a security. The liens on those fixed deposits wouldn't be disclosed. Meanwhile, this money would be routed, often via Merino Shelters, onwards to Man Industries. For that one day, the amount it had receivable from those companies would come down by tens of crores. The books it prepared that day would look much cleaner. By April though, it would give out fresh loans to this cabal of group companies once again. In FY2017, for instance, Man Industries had given a loan of over 110 crores to Man Reality through Merino Shelters. On March 31, 2017, a large part of that loan came back to it. And for that one day, its receivables went down by 53 crores. In April 2017 though, new loans had been pushed down the chain. Sometimes they would get even more creative. In 2020, for instance, Man Industries reported having a check in hand from Merino Shelters worth around 11.5 crores, supposedly to repay part of the loans that it had made. That check was treated as cash and that allowed the company to show a small amount of receivables. Only that check was never encashed and was cancelled in June that year. That said, Merino Shelter later repaid the amount through a bank transfer. But the point stands. At the end of FY2020, the company held a check that may or may not have been honored and called it cash in the bank. To an investor, the company didn't have much that was receivable, nor did it show much in the way of related party transaction. It simply netted out any money it had supposedly received. From the outside, there was no way of knowing the company's true exposure to related entities. Things looked under control even when they weren't. Now SEBI has handed Man Industries promoters and some of its key officials 2 years ban from the securities market. It has also handed out 25 lakh rupee penalty to all of them, amounting to 1 crore in total. Meanwhile, the company's shares had fallen by 16% when trading opened yesterday. But our point in covering these stories isn't to badmouth specific companies or people. It's to help you understand ways in which companies that look healthy might be hiding skeletons in their closet, so you know what to look for when you're doing your due diligence. There are times when this feels hard and the game seems rigged against you. A motivated insider can hide a lot more than you would even consider digging out from its financial reporting alone. As Warren Buffett once wrote, the deck is stacked against the favor of the deal that's coveted by the CEO and his or her obliging staff. This case is a clear demonstration of that fact. What you can do, however, is to look at the quality of the company's corporate governance. You can look at how independent a company's board seems or how comfortable auditors are with making qualifications. You can look at how often the company transacts with related parties and how transparent those dealings seem. Good governance can sometimes feel like a nice to have, especially in India, where most businesses, even the large ones, are the fief of a single family. But it isn't a luxury. It's often the only real line of defense between you and the risks hidden in plain sight. Now, coming to the tidbits. The Sahara Group has petitioned the Supreme Court for permission to sell over 88 prime properties, including Ambi Valley and Sahara City, Lucknow, to Adani Properties Private Limited. The proceeds, part of which already amount to 16,000 crore rupees, will go into SEBI Sahara refund account to repay investors, with a hearing on the plea set for October 14. Reliance Power has signed a share purchase agreement to sell its entire stake in 5 Indonesian coal subsidiaries to Singapore-based Biotruster PTE Limited for about $12 million. The deal, routed through its Netherlands and Singapore arms, will be completed subject to conditions, with proceeds payable on closure. From October 13, 2025, NSE International Exchange will start trading zero-day to expiry options on the Nifty 50 index. These contracts will end the same day at 3:30 p.m. Indian time, and at any time there will always be 5 weekly expiry contracts available to trade. And that's all the stories that I have for you today. Thank you for tuning in. See you in the next one.